I'm delighted to be here today with Michael. It's been a long time since we have made one of these for public consumption, Michael. And I had actually brought up a different topic a while back, and you got me onto this idea of narrative and how it seems to be showing up everywhere in these conversations that Jordan Peterson is having with John Vervaeke and Jonathan Peugeot. And I'm also noticing it pop up in the Daily Wire conversations around the Gospels. I wanted to talk about what exactly is narrative, how does it function in the world, and I think we need to get a handle on a definition because, on the one hand, I think of narrative as kind of another word for story, which is a kind of a data compression, and a lot of things can fall in that category. But in the world today, we use narrative in a somewhat pejorative sense to talk about. That's a particular perspective that somebody is pushing using as a method of controlling other people. And for the purposes of our conversation, I would like you to define narrative the way that you want to approach it, and then we'll dig into some of this stuff.
Just for simplicity's sake, I mean, I just when I use the term, I just use it in a very simple way of and basically just a series of events, and our any series of events like any that you can put some sort of through line through, like some connecting series of events. And I think what I got I think I sent you a YouTube video of back way back when of
Yes, indeed.
Peterson, Vervaeke, and Peugeot talking, and how I think it was 2021 or 2022, so back a couple years ago. And it was he mentions in that YouTube video that he's preparing to write his book at that time, and he's crediting both Peugeot and Vervaeke with influencing the ideas he's developing there, and wants to kind of get their early feedback. And that was on what he's going through there. And a big part of it is that narrative as a sort of interpretive structure for all of reality is what he's trying to point towards. And then the conversation starts to move sideways at different points because Vervaeke wants to kind of push back and say, well, I don't think we want to say that a narrative is as broad as just a series of events. And both Peugeot and Peterson sort of push back, but I feel like sort of unsuccessfully. I feel like that sort of very generic version is actually what makes narrative so powerful. It's a very simple, linear structure, right? It's just a any series of events has a beginning, middle, and end is in a certain sense a narrative. And then what's interesting about that, it's such a phenomenal data compression tool that it also almost always a narrative has pointers into it that go up levels of narrative and down levels of narrative. And so it's like it sort of has this Russian nesting doll effect that makes it in a certain sense it's very hard to describe, but I think just that very simple, like broad definition of it's a series of events. It's like this linear structure. It's like a is an easy way to describe it. Now, what all the implications and all the sort of, I don't know, interpretive neural network stuff going on and how we interact with those and like expand out from that linear structure, I think are really interesting to talk about as well. But like I think just in terms of defining it's I don't know, maybe this is overly broad, but I think that's a useful way to think about it. And I think their conversation suffered from their unwillingness to kind of give it that broad definition.
Well, I took some notes on what they said. So let's take a look at some of that. So Jonathan Peugeot said that narrative is the embodied manner in which we engage with a structure of value. So let's pick that apart. What does that mean? And the embodied manner in which we engage with a structure of value.
Well, I think what part of what that indicates is that all narratives are teleological in nature, in that there's always some end state that is embodied in that narrative structure of like, okay, we start at this point and we want to get to this point. And then there's sort of an infinite variety of better to worse in in getting from A to Z, you know, like, and so,
I mean, that would be Peterson's whole argument in Maps of Meaning, is in getting from A to B, anything can happen.
yeah, anything can happen. There's all sorts of anomalies. And then what you, I think narrative is fundamentally because we always are in a position of having to choose what to do. We always are, and because we're temporal creatures, we live in time. We're always viewing the world, perceiving the world, in terms of this sort of story context, and we're always sort of moving up and down the ladders of narrative, like in terms of like what story we're living in. Like, are we living in the story of like sort of ultimate purpose and meaning, or are we living in the story of like, you know, I'm driving my car and something weird just happened, like somebody ran out in front of me. Like, that forces us down levels of narrative, you know, into the very concrete details of what's happening now. Is kind of changing all the time. But again, because of that sort of what I was referring to earlier, that Russian nesting doll effect, everything ultimately in terms of like our value judgments about whether like what's better or worse is going to be aligned to that ultimate highest level story, whatever we're, and for different people, how that we conceive that and so forth is going to be different, but it's going to affect even like the smallest decisions that, like, you know, Peterson talks about, like even where you point your eyes, right? What you look at is a value judgment, and that will be influenced by what that highest level story that you have is.
Okay, so that highest level issue is one that hangs up John Vervaeke, and it's also, I was just listening this morning to episode 4, I think, of the Gospels, where they're talking about the issue of what does Peterson mean when he talks about that highest level, when he talks about the ineffable, what is he really getting at? And when he's talking about the transcendent, is he talking about the same thing that Vervaeke means when Vervaeke says the self-transcendent? Vervaeke says the self-transcendent is not a narrative, but when Peterson is talking about the highest level being our aim, that should be our aim, and that highest level is something ineffable beyond our ability to see, they get into that discussion,
Yeah.
and it made me think back to this deeper into the weeds discussion that they had several years back that you brought up at the beginning here. And in that one, John Vervaeke says, self-transcendence is not a narrative, but it's above narrative. And then Peterson comes in and says, well, that's a meta narrative.
Yeah.
Don't know that solves the problem, but that's what he says. And then Vervaeke comes in and starts talking about the nomological. And he says, that's what science does because naming things is different from telling a story. So, what do you think about that idea from Vervaeke that naming things is different from telling a story?
I don't think so. I think that the name contains the story in miniature form. Like,
I mean, that's what I was thinking. Because if you just think about the word, which is the simplest
yeah.
embodied story that there is, the word, which is the word at the beginning of time when God says, "Light be." That word "be," you know, light be, and then light is. That word, that look at what's encapsulated in that one word.
Yeah.
Story
Well,
that's
yeah,
there.
I think, yeah, going back to Barfield as well, like, I mean, like, we tend to think about our own sort of instrumental use of language and as sort of the end all and be all of what language is. But we just kind of forget that every word is its own story. I mean, I think, I don't know, maybe even Peterson at one point, I don't know if it was in the video we were referring to, but talks about, like, you know, like the words that are their shortest in our vocabulary are often the oldest words, because over time they've gotten kind of shaved down because they're just used so frequently that they get we can we want to use the maximal, like, they get chopped down as short as possible. But through that evolution of time, they've just collected, there's so much attached into those words that is, you could say, in one sense, it's being transmitted at a cultural level, but even more so, it's dealing with fundamental, biological facts of what it means to be a human or alive, or a creature that, lives in time and space and so forth, that is all inherited in just that word. So, I think, yeah, every word has a very long story, of which some parts of it we are consciously aware of, and a much kind of richer, deeper, beneath the iceberg component of that we are sort of unconsciously tapped into or not even aware of.
So then here's another
But
question.
I just to go back to John Verveke's point, I do think he has a point in terms of something like saying, like, where he's talking about, like, this quote unquote meta narrative, like to say that the sort of shape or component of the narrative of narratives is itself not a narrative. I get the argument he's making, but to me, it sort of reeks of this scientific mode of being, to try and get to this sort of objective third person point of view, to kind of jump out of our temporal, spatial constraints, and suddenly get to this, this point of view that stands outside everything and can, have the end all be all perspective. And I'm like, I just, it's,
That's what I was going to
I
say. It's kind of, you have to remove choice and you have to remove time in order to
yeah.
make self-transcendence.
In the way, whatever way we can relate to the quote unquote meta story, it's still going to use those same interpretive frame, whatever interpretive framework we're interacting with stories all the time. It's also being applied at that meta, whatever that meta story layer is as well. It's
Well, I
like,
mean, it's Peterson that calls it a meta story or a meta narrative. Verveke is just saying it's self-transcendence, and I wonder if, in his mind, if he's thinking of experiences that he has had during meditation where he transcends self into what I'm assuming. I mean, I have not done that kind of meditation, but I'm assuming he's talking about a place within meditation where time has no meaning and where choice has no meaning because you're just inhabiting this space of self-transcendence. So,
yeah, but even the insights you take, you receive in those environments of quote unquote transcendence is, like, has to be lived out in some way in your life, right? It still has to be unpacked back into a framework that is essentially narrative in scope, which is our lived life. Like, how what are you good? Well, like,
And
in a
if it
certain
can be
sense,
unpacked, it has to be
and
some
if it
sort of a
can't
data
be, in some
compression.
sense, it's, I would say it's not really real. It might, it's I don't know. In some sense, if it's not lived out in some, time and space component, it's sort of a fiction of some sort. So I don't know. I think, yeah, the semantics here are heavily influenced by our scientific mode of discourse. Because I was thinking back, I've watched that. I remember having the sort of inclination or imperative that Peugeot and Peterson give way too easily to Verveke in that conversation. I'm like, well, why is that? Because it's like, I feel like they had all the good arguments on their side, but they still seem, there's a sort of deference there to this scientific mode of using language to always be a much more narrow scope. Like, it's the most gauche thing you can do to sort of casually use a turn of phrase and not use it in a very precise descriptive tool. Like, and again, this sort of imagines that what words are, these sort of boxes of delineated space that we, have very precise, boundaries on. And that's sort of complete opposite of what I was referring to, where this story has this long, lengthy history or story for how it even came into being and how it's been used in a millions of different contexts. Again, these are contexts, some of which you're privy to and many of which you're not, and yet still is a big part of how you use it today, right? Because you didn't invent that word. So to pretend that we kind of have these, like, we can use language this way, I think is, I think obviously there's lots of value that we derive in certain contexts from using language in this way to be precise and to kind of scale ourselves up across, you know, people from different backgrounds, and the scientific endeavor relies on all of these tricks. But I'm just, I sometimes I think it, again, it's sort of, we spend so much time in these modes of analytic thought that we sort of think they're representative of reality. That to me seems sort of obvious, the case that it's not, you know, it's not representative of the sort of fundamental mode of how language actually exists
Well,
and is able to
and it's
function.
the, I mean, it's the whole argument that science cannot be completely objective and inhabiting a space that's some sort of objective outside of subjectivity space, because there's always going to be that interpretive lens of what theory do you choose? What experiment do you choose to, find meaning in your theory? What approach do you want to take? So just let me throw in something else here. So in that same old conversation, John Vervaeke says that narrative is telling a story, but Pajot says narrative is the structure of the universe. I mean, those are two pictures that are about as far apart as you can get, actually. I mean, I should say Vervaeke says narrative is just telling a story. In the whole story is right in that just there, because just telling a story is not, in Peugeot's view, is not different than the structure of the universe.
Yeah. And also, you know, the other points that Peterson makes there, he talks about like the wolf pack, that in some sense they're acting out the story, but then it doesn't become a story until we the scientist comes along and turns like what they do into some descriptive series of events. I don't think that's the case. I think again that linear structure, I think, is actually there. I mean, at some point in us biologically, like at all layers, you know, there's some sort of, I don't, in like, I don't know how to talk about it without getting some woo, but I think, you know, like there's some level at which, you know, there has to be some sort of story level of memory and habit and so forth, even at like the layer of an individual cell. So I'm not just talking about like, you know, the sort of stuff that exists in our brain that obviously, you know, has all this cultural impact from how we're raised and so forth. Though I do think there's a lot of important stuff there. I think this, whatever this is so fundamental. It goes down into levels that we can't even describe. But again, I think they're fundamental in the fact that, again, we're always acting in time. So, I mean, when I say a story again, I mean something even as simple as the story of, like, you know, going home and, you know, unlocking your door with a key. Like, there's so many aspects of that that you probably don't have to, because you've encoded all the linear processes into like such a fine-grained level. You don't have to even consciously be aware of them normally, unless you're making some sort of major error in some component. You know, like you have the wrong key or something like that. Like there's and so a lot of times we're not even consciously aware of all the stories we're inhabiting and acting out, because, I mean, for some of them are below the conscious layer. You know, anyway, like I'm not really consciously aware of my breathing or like all the other metabolic functions going on in my body, but they're still kind of like foundational components of me, even though I'm not really aware of them. But
I think one of the beautiful things that when you brought up the issue of the cell at the cell level is that whole picture. In fact, in episode four, when they're talking about the Sermon on the Mount, Peterson goes on to give a description of what it means to live in community and live towards this transcendent aim. And he does quite a beautiful description of that whole process. And it's exactly the process of the way the cells develop into a body and support the body and sacrifice themselves on behalf of the body. And and that the whole thing working towards this aim of the body developing and then acting as a functioning community. It's a perfect description, almost as though that whole process and pattern of the body developing is there as a picture for us so that we can understand what it is that is it Paul in Corinthians, yes, who talks about the body
Yeah.
and makes that apparent to us. Okay, these are things that we've learned now that make that story deeper and richer than it was when it was first told, which is, what you're always saying about the evolution of language. It gets deeper and richer because of the new stories that inhabit it and become a part of the current story. But when you were talking about, like, when you come home and you unlock the door, you don't need to think about it unless something gets in the way. That was when Peugeot was talking about this whole thing of the narrative and the structure of universe. He says you don't need an ethic unless you notice the difference. If you come to a place where you notice that there's a disparity, or that there is an anomaly, or that something has gotten in the way, then you need an ethic in order to help you navigate that difference, right?
And it, what's interesting about these stories, it's just it's such a fundamental component of it's like narrative, and the combination of narrative and language is really kind of the symbolic of consciousness. And so it's we can't listen to or perceive the story without, in some sense, putting ourselves into that story in some meaningful components, because that, in some sense, that's how we understand the story. We sort of we put ourselves, we even know this, like biologically, we have these things like mirror neurons, like where we're watching someone eat ice cream, we're sort of we get pleasure from that as well, because we're sort of experiencing the eating the ice cream as well, sort of. And the same thing when we're hearing stories about something. And I think the better the stories are, the more facets of our consciousness get kind of subsumed in that story. Like, I think a really great example that I always think about is Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. If you've ever read that book, like, and it really let it get a hold of you, it's like, it's almost like you are the person that did this awful murder. Like, that's it's such a psychologically gripping work. But that's that capability exist, I think, because, again, this is such a sort of fundamental. It's not like you don't do work to do that, right? It's not like you go to a movie and have to, like, go, okay, now I'm going to imagine that this is all real, even though I know it's not. Like, there's no effort involved there, because it's kind of mapping into some base layer of what we're doing all the time.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, in theatrical terms, they call it the willing suspension of disbelief. And maybe it is that our default is always disbelief, but somehow when we read a book or watch a movie, that we're willing to let go of the default. Do you think we're by default skeptical?
Well, I mean, we have certain patterns of what stories look like. I mean, if some weirdo, like postmodern guy, decided to create some inversion of all stories, and it was just a compl like we would react instantly to that, because, in some sense, for we understand stories as well, because they come in a whole tradition of storytelling that we're familiar with. And every, like, no filmmaker or author writes in a vacuum. They're kind of writing a tradition of other things that we're, again, to the degree that they're successful, they really tied in deep to something fundamental to who we are, right? And so, and every artist that comes in their wake is borrowing bits and pieces from those sort of tropes and stereotypes and, like, patterns to kind of craft what they do. And so we need some of that. We need some of that structure that we recognize, or we won't understand it. And then we also need some level of sort of novelty or strangeness or newness or some new, sort of new insight, or we're not interested to kind of see, like, what's going on. But I don't think we have to. I don't think we're necessarily. I don't know what's. I think we are so des we're such cultural creatures, and we so desire to know. And what's most interesting to us in a lot of contexts is, what do other people know, and what are they thinking? That, like, anytime you're hearing a story, you're interested, even if it's to give your own critique that that's a bad story. You're really tuned in.
So one of the other discussions that you and I have had sort of offline is this debate that Peterson and Peugeot and Verveke had about whether or not melody is a narrative. So I thought maybe we could tackle that question. Is melody a narrative? In what way is it a narrative? In what way is it a data compression? And what can we learn from that?
Well, in my very simplistic definition, like a series of events, it obviously fits the bill because I'm being really broad there. But I think it clearly is a narrative because, again, the way it so fundamentally has these emotional resonances with us that like we almost can't even describe. Like, but you can't, in some sense, are undeniable as well. So when Peterson and Peugeot sort of hemmed and hawed at whether, because that was part of Verveke's big pushback was, well, like if what you're saying is true, then a melody would be a narrative. I don't think we want to say that. We don't want to get that sloppy with our language, And I was like thinking, well, it's obvious. I mean, what else could it be? That I mean, there's it has all those progressions and movements and a feeling of depths of meaning that are there that again it sort of unfold through a temporal landscape that I think yeah that to me has all the hallmarks of what I would call a narrative.
Well, and the thing about melody is that the good melodies, yes, I mean there is novelty, which keeps us interested, but it's not so much novelty that you can't at least feel maybe not comfortable is the word, but you can feel both a longing for what the next note is, and when the next note comes, a feeling of yes, it had to be that. That one of the things I've noticed with a lot of modern music, where some of the new worship leaders in the church are writing music trying to respond to the modern world, is that they try to come up with melodies that are so radically different that as a singer sitting in the pew who doesn't know what the next note is, I can't even make a guess. I can't get there.
Yeah.
And even when they sing it for me, and then I go and I try to sing it a second time, it's like that note doesn't make sense. It doesn't fit. It just isn't a compelling narrative.
Right.
And I think it's because they're trying too hard to go after some novelty. But actual melodies that are powerful are the ones that have this sort of sengsukt in them, that sense of longing and something that draws you forward, and that at the same time, when you get there, makes sense of all the notes that came before it.
Yeah, there's a drama and there's the dissonance and then along with anytime you get dissonance, what you're promising in a musical piece is some sort of reconciliation of that dissonance and some sort of harmony at the end that often is part of that. I always have found it really interesting. Tolkien, in his accounting of the creation of his world, he talks about his creator basically singing into existence, and so there's, and I think it's true with a lot of folks that have studied language that as you go back further and further in time, there's more and more of a poetic quality to the language that I think is what maybe gets Tolkien, under the influence of Barfield to, and I'm curious if they even maybe had talks about this, in terms of the Inklings discussions about like maybe originally language was musical in nature because, poetry and music always have had this kind of intertwining of how they're used. And so, and I've heard a lot of people like kind of speculate that maybe it originally there was like, speech was had this sort of musical quality to it, that is kind of been lost to us, but is because even like something like the 18th and 19th century, back when they still called it philology, they talked about and they were trying to get to more like trying to come up with theories that were more driven by evolution and so forth to explain language. They were kind of stumped by this what they called like this sort of poetical period of language. Like How did all these, why was like this sort of dominance of this poetical mode of speech way back when? Which is sort of difficult to explain from a sort of evolutionary perspective. And also
Sort of impossible
along
to
with
explain from an evolutionary
that
perspective.
poetical mode of speech is also a sort of, and we've talked about this before when talking about Barfield, like the combination of the inner and the outer modes of what a word means, where they had all these sort of like for them, again, a word wasn't like a simple box. It was very clear it wasn't. It was expressing more of a spirit or a sort of range of phenomena were grouped together that we today would not see as being related at all. It's like, for instance, like the wind and spirit and so forth. We don't connect those things at all. But like for them, that was like obviously you would use the same words, and both things were sort of happening in them together, in ways that we don't see anymore.
Well, I mean, it's almost the way that a single note has all these overtones and harmonics that are happening, but because we're not such sensitively tuned instruments in terms of our hearing, we don't hear all the overtones. All that we hear is the fullness of the tone, the richness of the tone, but we don't hear all those overtones that are happening. And words can be that way too. We can hear a word, we can sense the richness of the word, but we're not really thinking of all the different ways that that word connects to everything else, right? I was just reading an essay today that was talking about that the Iluvatar at the beginning of time in the
Oh, yeah.
Silmarillion singing the world into existence. And then the author went on to talk about Melkor.
Yep.
Or Morgoth, who then became Morgoth, being wanting desperately to sing his own ideas into existence, but his singing was discordant. And the discordance of it began to draw others in the singing towards his own tones, which were discordant. Away from the general path of the beauty and the harmony and everything of the singing. And it made me think about how, like, when you're in a choir, have you ever sung in a choir before?
Not since I was very young.
Well, if a choir is attempting to go a cappella, if there's somebody in the choir that tends to be a little bit off, maybe they're a little bit flat or something, over time, the choir will have a tendency to fall towards that lowest common denominator and go along with the person who's off, because otherwise the whole choir starts to sound very discordant. So you want to accommodate. But the big problem comes in if you're in a choir and you start out a cappella, but then the symphony orchestra is going to come in at a certain point. If you're not in pitch, it's not going to work, right? So you have to train yourself not to listen to the discordant one and to listen to the one, because there are always a few people in a choir that have perfect pitch that can maintain the perfect pitch. And you have to train yourself who you're going to listen to. And so
Interesting.
when I was reading that thing about Melkor and Morgoth, it made me think about that you don't want to let yourself fall into the pattern of the one who is off, you know.
Yeah, I think in that story too, like part of the story is how the creator is able to somehow encapsulate the discordant notes and yet create something even more beautiful in terms of like he's able to envelop it in a way that it the intention to sow discord is, is actually overcome.
Of course. I mean, if you think about Lord of the Rings and the horror that Sam and Frodo have to go through on the way to Mount Doom, there is a beauty that comes out of that. Absolutely, no question. There's a beauty that comes out of it. But man, the amount of suffering and pain that they have to go through to get there. So many things came out of this whole bunch of thinking, but you were talking about going down to the cell level. I started thinking about going down even to the particle level. are there stories embedded in the particle level? And one of the things that I remember stumbling upon early in this channel was a lecture by a woman who's a particle physicist. And in this lecture, she's talking about what. So she decided to look at very, very small particles that could be created through nanotechnology that would all be identical, make a whole bunch of identical particles. And she made them of. She'd make a whole bunch of them of one shape and a whole bunch of them of another shape. And so she's just working with one shape at a time. And what happens if you put all these particles into a space and then you begin removing the space around them? So squeezing the amount of space that they're allowed to be in, what happens to them? And she discovered that these particles will self-organize. I mean, we have to use language like that, right? But obviously, there's no, is there a self to each particle and are they organizing? But anyway, they self-organize into a crystalline structure, a perfect crystalline structure that is based on finding the greatest degree of freedom for each particle. Now, you think about that. Each particle wants to have as much space as it can have. And so they will. Self-organize into this perfect crystalline structure. And the crystalline structure differs depending on what the shape of the particle is. So spherical particles will go into a certain structure. Particles that have different surfaces and faces to them and everything will go into a different kind of a structure. And so she's done a lot of research on that. And to me, that's really fascinating.
Yeah, I remember talking you talking about that a while back. I'm curious, what are they? She actually does the experiment, or she just
Yeah.
models it? Okay.
Well, I think some of it was modeled and some of it was actually done.
She did. Okay,
I
that's
think some
yeah.
of it
It's
was modeled
super
and some of it
interesting.
was done because in order to do as many different shapes as she did, that had to be modeled because I mean she did every shape that was conceivable. And but yeah, I would have to go back and look at that to see whether it was all modeled or whether some of it was actual physical particles. I mean, they're not particles in the sense of atoms. They're little tiny things,
Yeah.
right?
Like even below the level of atom, or just
Oh
or
no, not below the
no.
level of atom
Okay.
because she wouldn't be able to make those things, right? But
You wouldn't think so.
the interesting aspect of it for me was that what she said was, you see, this happens only through entropy. And I thought, well, it's not entropy alone that's doing that because she's affecting the experiment. She's removing the space.
Yeah.
So you've got someone from the outside, which is the problem with Verveke's whole idea of the self-transcendent thing not being a narrative. Of course, there has to be a narrative there because unless he's saying that when a person transcends self, they're no longer in control to impose a narrative.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, again, I don't, maybe I'm misunderstanding him, because I feel this sort of, again, this urge to get to that objective third person perspective that is, I don't know is necessarily attainable. But it also, it makes me wonder as well, like sort of in terms of our larger perspectives, is, I don't know, like, I think there's, we also have maybe questions in our current frame about how deeply the divine is able to participate at this narrative level, and because that's, theologically how I would describe it, and I wonder if that doesn't give us sort of this impetus to try and to in our pursuit of the good to try and escape this structure, to kind of get to transcend it, because that's in some sense the only way we can actually really find ourselves in union with the good. But I think from my perspective, I think that the whole, sort of mystery of the incarnation is about trying to kind of blow up that perception, and that, and to point towards a true union between the infinite and the finite. in our perspective, because we're on this side, is always going to at least start from that finite mode. Now, what does I agree with Verveke and others that there's some mode of transcendence, but I think as long as we're still on this side of, not fully in union with the divine, we're still we're it's going to be always translated through these this interpretive narrative framework. And I don't know, I just tend towards a suspicion of anything that claims to have sort of broke that boundary limit and is now sitting outside of it and can now pronounce judgment on the whole thing and tell us, yeah, that's just kind of my limited perspective on it.
When you're talking about somebody breaking the boundary and sitting outside of it, are you talking about, like, for example, the scientist who says, I can look objectively at the universe and make decisions about, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, well, I think there, by necessity, there's something reductionistic about it, right? Because again, like you are a finite being, and now you're claiming to have this sort of quote unquote insight into the whole. So, sort of necessarily, there's going to be a lot of data compression in there, and I don't want to discount any value or tools. I just don't, for me, like the what I'm suspicious of is the claims of it being somehow ultimate or actually having gotten outside of the thing it claims to be outside of. Like I don't think we are actually getting outside of these narrative structures. Like I think as long as we're bounded in time, we're still our language, everything about us, our modes of being are extruding it through that temporal, interpretive framework of the narrative.
Well, that's very analogous to what Wolfram is talking about when he says we are observers within a certain kind of slice of computational reducibility. And because of that, we can only see what we can see from within that slice because that's where we are. We're embedded in the environment, and you can't get outside that environment and have some look at the whole thing. And that's, I'm sure that's a pretty scary thing for a scientist to say, to get out in front and say that. Although I noticed that that is not one of the things that most people get on him about. Most people get on him about trying to find relativity within his nodes and edges universe. But what he's saying about
I
the
think there's a
observer
real,
is
yeah, there's
really.
real honesty in terms of like how limited our perspectives are in that
Yeah.
conception of his. Which actually I saw recently him in a debate with, it was supposed to be a debate, but it really didn't end up being much of a debate because he was talking with this guy that was like, what's this guy's name? He's one of these people that believes AI is going to kill us all and, take over. And it's like, for him, it's just an absolute certainty.
Eliezer Yudkowsky?
Yeah. And he's
Okay.
basically, they're supposed to be having a debate about, is AI going to kill us? And Wolfram is basically just undermining all of his premises from this. Like, so it's this continue rapid hole, like where the guy's getting increasingly frustrated that that Wolfram doesn't accept his premises. Cause he's like, the guy's like, oh, well, the AI is going to be smart and it's going to be smart to like a billion times smarter than us. And then, certainly they're going to kill us. Like if only accidentally, cause they're so smarter. And he's kind of like, what? And he's going into his ideas about the real yet. He's like, well, there's also a trillion, trillion, trillion ways of being smart. What makes you think the AI is going to even care about being smart in the ways that, even have any sort of like, intersection with things we care about? Like, and so like he, and this guy was kind of really thrown by, that. It was really interesting to see though, because what I liked about it was because typically scientists, their reductionist mode of reasoning leads them to like absolute certainty in all sorts of domains, even well outside the scope of like where they actually have real expertise and knowledge. And Wolfram's idea is like more like he's just had this like his mind blown with this idea of like, okay, most of reality is computationally irreducible. And we have these little slices that we can do our little tricks of reducibility, but any speculation outside that, like, yeah, I don't buy it, is kind of his frame now. So he was just undermining every one of the guy's premises.
Well, as long as we're on this whole issue of computational stuff, I want to share something with you. Let's see if I can drag it up here. I was reading an article from Daily Wire today. Let's see, can you see this note?
I can.
Okay. The print is not very large. What can I do to expand this? Let's see.
You can usually do a command plus plus sometimes, but
I'm not very good at this, but we'll get it a little bit bigger. So down here, there's this highlighted section down at the bottom of the screen. What else did Jesus in? So this is from a Daily Wire article about the episode on the Sermon on the Mount, and there's going to be a quote in here from Jordan Peterson, but I don't know who wrote the article. It's just somebody from Daily Wire. They didn't put their name on it. What else did Jesus intend to communicate symbolically through the living water that he offered the woman at the well? What else did Jesus intend to communicate by performing healings? What else did Jesus intend to communicate by fulfilling Old Testament prophecies of the Messiah's coming? So, I mean, these are really big questions, that it wasn't that there's more to the story, I guess, would be the basic idea of these questions. So Jordan wants to discover those answers. And one of the things that Jordan talks about earlier is that when he came to the Bible, he came to it with a humble attitude. This is something I don't know anything about, and I want to know more about it. And he didn't come to it with an attitude of, oh yeah, I've heard about this before and I know all these things about it. He came to it with an attitude of, I'm just going to explore this as something I don't know anything about, and I'm going to see what I can learn. So here's what Jordan says. He says, I've been thinking we are on the verge of something like computational epistemology. He says, intending that meaning is not arbitrary. Tradition brings meaning to the forefront, making the most potent and actual relationships within the text not merely interpretive, but rather reflective of meaning. Now, what do you make of that phrase, computational epistemology?
I don't know. I'm curious. So when I hear computation, my mind goes immediately to a sort of formal systems and so forth, which are inherently limited in their capabilities and what they're able to reference. But I wonder if he's meaning something deeper or richer. I know I was what's funny enough, I stumbled across an old conversation you had with Glenn where you guys were talking about I think you were talking about Gödel's theorem and the halting problem in computation. He was alluding to a much sort of more richer sense of computation as opposed to just something that's stuck within a formal system.
Yeah, he
And
calls it a symphony of choices over time.
I guess I don't have a good paradigm to understand that or comment on it, but it's
Well, his picture of the symphony of choices over time is that in order to do that computation, in order for it to be computational, there has to be a symphony, and then there have to be musicians. The symphony has to have been transliterated onto sheets of paper that show the pattern of the symphony, and then there have to be musicians that are skilled in playing their instruments and skilled in being able to read what's on the documents. And then when all of that is put together, then you get a symphony out the other end of it. So you have a symphony to start with, and you get a symphony on the other end. But the symphony that you get on the other end is obviously all the compression has been zipped open, and now you have not only the notes on the page, but you have the sounds and the community of people working together, and we have all of that happening in the final result. And I wonder if that's the kind of computation that Jordan has stumbled on here when he says computational epistemology.
What's screaming at me, given the gospel context as well, is I supposedly, I don't know if this is true, but I've heard it said multiple times that the number one thing that Jesus says to other people is, "What do you want?" in the gospels. I don't know if that's true or not, but I've heard that. I do think that when you were talking about that symphony of choice, that's what I'm hearing is like, is Jesus so often, again, he speaks in parable. He sort of is veiling what he does through this sort of, some would say, opaque or vague, narrative lens of these parables. But he what he's tr he's trying to stir up in somebody, even in those, I think, a sense of their own desires and what they want. And at the end, like, the question of what do you want is ultimately sort of the question of who do you want to be, at its most fundamental layer. And so, I wanted to connect that to something, but it just kind of eluded me. Oh, I was thinking, that conversation with Jordan Hall, where he was talking about his experiences in the going through the hurricane. And there was like a sort of pivot point in the conversation that really just, like, I don't know, just rang like a bell for me, when he was saying, like, in the kind of midst of all the pressure of that situation, he made this comment about people living into the story that everybody wants to live into, or something like, I'm massacring what he said. It was very precise, and he sort of thought about it for, like, I don't know, a good, you could tell he was being very careful about exactly how he said it. And it really, I don't know, just stood out to me, like, exactly that. I think, Peterson always talks about how, in some sense, like, if you took, there's some sense in which the story of Jesus is sort of like, this summation of all the heroes of all stories of all time, or sort of like sublimated into the narrative of the gospels and who Jesus is, and sort of that hero narrative. And I do think that's sort of what's really calling to us, in the story, is this desire of, like, what do we, a revelation of who we are and what we really want, and how what we really want is to live into a story where we're acting the way we see Jesus acting, in terms of his communion both with his father and what his father is doing, that kind of holistic perspective, but then bringing that down into all these, like, little details of how he's patient with somebody, and how he's able to be present and attentive to all these little, minute, like, the Gospels is such a, it's almost, it doesn't feel like an ancient narrative. It's just got all these weird little, twists and turns of details that feel very, it really pulls you into this, like, character of this person of Jesus. And I, another thing that came out of the Peterson Paggio Verveke conversation we keep referring to, is at one point, I think maybe it was Reiki or Pajo, like, talked about, oh, well, really is in light, like, the kind of, like, what we talk about, in Christian narratives, is that the truth is a person, or like the, so that, like, as a means of exploding again that narrative lens, is kind of the frame it was brought up in. But again, I think our most telling insights into what other people are, and knowing other people in person as persons, is that story, I think it's why, a big part of what TLC has become is people, talking about all these abstract ideas, but somehow there's always, like, some deep tie-in to people's personal stories, because people aren't really doing this for the money or anything else. Like there's some reason this little, big idea has captured them, and they need to talk about it in depth, and are, like, the compelled to do so, that links back to their story. And when people, are talking about the details of their personal story, there's something, I don't know, there's, like, for me, something just kind of sort of glows with light around that, where you're like, You might not necessarily agree with a person 100%, but you know there's something sort of undeniable, a nugget of real experience that you can't really look away from. You're kind of it's just very, at least for me, it's incredibly compelling.
And that I think that ties in with one of the things that they were talking about in the Sermon on the Mount episode on the Daily Wire Plus thing on the Gospels, because they get into this place where they're talking about not seeking after, not desiring the stuff of that comes from doing God's will, or the stuff that comes from obedience, the benefits that might attach to being obedient, not to desire that, but to just desire God's will in us, that's the ultimate desire, which is basically what you're talking about, that the life of Jesus would be lived out through us, whatever that means, whatever that means, whatever stuff might accrue from it or not accrue from it, or whatever suffering might come from it, just to know that we are in his will and that we are living his will, that is the greatest desire to go after. And I just think it's really interesting how this whole group of people coming from such different world views all agree on that thing, all coming together on that. And I think that fits right in with what you said. What do you want? And who is really the question of who do you want to be? Well, I want to be like Jesus. But then there's all this fear around what is that actually going to look like on a moment by moment basis in my life? And you know, that's a very big question.
And I don't think, in some sense, we can't even desire that properly until we have the grace of some sort of revelation of God's goodness, right? Because in some sense, it's really hard to trust ourselves to this process until we really have some grander, vision of how beautiful and good God is, such that you can kind of commit yourself to it. When Jesus teaches his disciples to pray, "Not my will, but thine be done," it's that's really kind of a crux, right, of this whole thing that you were just referring to, with like not wanting the stuff per se, but trying to actually get an alignment to the true north of what goodness, truth, and beauty is. Which, again, in some sense, we all desire that, but we all have so many misapprehensions about what that really is and looks like for us and the people we care about, that it's, if we were focused on any sort of near approximate, goal, getting this outcome or that outcome, we don't have, like I said earlier, like this nested dolls of, stories and layers going all the way up. We don't have the ability to kind of figure out how those map, without some, without some belief that we can sort of lay down our will and it actually accomplishes something towards this, participating with actually what God is doing. So, like, we can be like Jesus, where he says, I only do what I see my Father doing. I think is in some sense something we all deeply want and desire, but to your point, like, we're sort of we don't we often aren't in a position of trusting ourselves that we can actually lay down our life to live into that narrative.
Well, and Peterson talked about this a lot in the biblical lectures, how easy it is to get sidetracked by a goal rather than the goal. So maybe while you're trying to live into the highest good of which you can conceive, you get the idea, oh, well, I should go to college so that I can get a degree, so that I can better serve my community, so that, and all the so that's, all of that links up to this highest goal. But then if you get trapped in the goal of finishing college, then when you finish, you have no more goal, and then you have no more meaning in your life, and then everything stops, and then you get depressed and fall into despair. because you got trapped by the benefits that were accruing out of following that goal rather than continuing to follow the goal, which has to be, you know, who do you want to be ultimately? And I mean, sometimes when I pray, it's a silly prayer probably, but Lord, just make me a faithful handmaiden. Whatever that looks like, I don't even know what that means. I don't know what it looks like. And I often despair that there's no way I can get there, which obviously I can't. If he's not working in me and through me and carrying me, let's say, to get to that goal, there's no way I can get there. But to make that my goal, or you know, maybe I need a higher goal than that, you know, that I might be eternally indwelt by the living God. I mean, that's a pretty scary thing to even say, you know, and even consider that that might be my desire. And yet that's what we're told all the time, right?
I think we struggle. This is definitely from the truth for myself. It's just like we struggle to believe how good the story that we're being told is, you know, the real depths of what the good news is.
Well, so let's go back to this idea that that the word, even a word and the word, is a narrative, is a story, is fundamentally something that includes time and choice and a series of events. Here's a quote for you, and this is something Barfield said. He said, "There will be a revival of Christianity when it becomes impossible to write a manual of science without referring to the incarnation of the word." What do you think of that? Shall I repeat it?
Yeah, do it 'cause
Okay. There will be a revival of Christianity when it becomes impossible to write a manual of science without referring to the incarnation of the word. Do you think we're getting close to
I think so. I think, you know, we I think there is something fundamentally Christian about, you know, w why science developed in the West. It's about a specific narrative where, and I think it's specifically a Christian narrative because it has to do with, I honestly think like in the ancient world, in some sense, like, there was something sort of about the sort of the muck of the dirt and so forth, the details of life on this earth that was sort of beneath the intellectual's contemplation, you know, like it was like that, oh, like the things that are perfect are up there in the stars, and you know, they have these regular bodies, but down here it's just sort of like it's disaster and muck and chaos. And there was something about the incarnation that establishes something where we're like, no, we can look at the details of nature and expect to find the handiwork of God there too, you know, this that there that God is not a far off God, that he is actually deigned to become one with, you know, with the creation in some real way. And so that we can expect to that there's going to be an order there that maybe we can't perceive right now, but we if we look long enough, we can be confident that we'll find it, you know. I think in, you know, in that conversation with Verveke, you know, Peterson talks about the, you know, the what sort of story must a scientist be living in that they can look at a microscope for hours and hours and think that they're doing something useful. There's all kinds of layers of a story that got us to that point. And I think we've sort of abandoned some of the basic Christian presuppositions, which is why I feel like, I mean, I don't know, it feels like there's sort of a science in a lot of ways have stalled at many different areas. You know, it feels like we're kind of like rehashing the same terrain, or like, you know, not making real inquiry. So I think Barfield's on to something. I've actually, what's funny is I've referenced that quote so many times myself, and yet every time I hear it, it's such a huge thing to contemplate. Like I'm sort of, it just sort of throws me every time I hear it. Like, but I, at the one sense, it's sort of like an audacious claim, but in this other sense, it absolutely rings true to me. Like I don't know. We've disassociated. There's something about our conceptions of heaven and earth that are completely so far apart right now that we can't, you know. And this, I think this is sort of what Barfield's project is, and I think Peterson's project is. It's to get these modes of language of you know, talking about heaven and earth back together, so
Well,
that they can talk.
let's think for just a second about a manual of science. What would such a thing be?
I think he means like this sort of pedagogical tools that we present to our, you know, the people that we're trying to get onto. Like, what's this whole science thing? I'm new here. What's going on? And like, once we're at the point where we realize that's an actual foundational component that we've neglected in terms of how we actually do science.
Well, don't you think we got closer to that coming through the pandemic and in the way that the news media approached the whole idea of science when they started calling it the science? Believe the science, follow the science, as though science itself is some sort of transcendent perfection rather than a method, which, I mean, science was always taught in schools. Previously was always taught as a method through which you discover truth.
Well,
But
I think
in
that's
recent years, we're supposed to believe that the science has all the answers instead of thinking science is a pursuit of answers. And sometimes the answers that they find are good ones and sometimes they aren't.
I think it's sort of a tell when everything, whenever, you know, I can't remember who said this. Maybe I heard Peter Thiel say it, so I'm ripping him off. But I think everybody has the same sense, is that anytime we talk about science as science, it's almost always indicating the fact how far science has actually fallen from its high standard that we had for it. So it's always almost always used in the sense of some sort of, you know, trying to a defending of institutions now, where he's, and I think Peter Thiel makes this point. He's like, if you anything you add the word science to, it almost certainly isn't a science, you know, like social science or like, you know, all these climate science, like there's all these things that like it's there to kind of I don't know, give the appearance of science to something that really has kind of deviated so far from, you know, what's recognizable about science. You know, I think we're at a point now where there's sort of widespread recognition that our sense making apparatuses have gotten off course. I don't know. It doesn't feel yet like there's a widespread consensus about where to go from here. But it does feel like there's some sort of shifting point where people are like, okay, whatever we've been doing doesn't work, you know, and we're missing something, and we gotta, you know, figure out what to do next. But I don't, you know.
I think that brings us back to where we started when we were dividing out the two meanings of narrative. If we look at the one meaning of narrative, meaning coming at something with a story that puts a frame around it so that you get a definite interpretation of the story, then using science as an arm of propaganda would be that definition of narrative. So there is a definite narrative around science nowadays. But if we look at narrative as simply relating a series of events, there will always be an interpretive frame. But if that, what makes the difference? Is it the context through which it's interpreted?
Well,
Because if you, if just let me
it's
try to get the thought out here.
okay.
So if it's legitimate science where you have a an idea or a theory and then you design an experiment to carry out to discover more about the theory, and there are certain steps that you take in the experiment, then there's a narrative there. There's a storyline there. There's a through line of what's happening. But if your goal at the end of that is to discover truth, then you're going to be like Nima Arcani Hamed talked about. You have to be ruthlessly truthful with yourself and with others, because if you lie about your findings, you're only going to hurt yourself and ultimately the scientific endeavor.
Yeah.
So
Well,
maybe it's the intentionality that makes the difference.
it's that's a big part of it, but it's also like whether the scientific narrative that you're working with is actually a lens you're using to instruct your further investigation of a particular area. That's one way mode of consciousness. And the other mode of consciousness is where, like, the whatever the sort of narrative framework of the day, the quote unquote science, is now become some sort of dead dogma that now is starting to be doubted, and everybody needs to rally around it and, like, run propaganda for, because people are starting to doubt that it's really the thing in itself, right? Because if it was so self-evident, nobody would need to defend it, right? Like, we would need that. And so and I think this, I mean, a scientist, in as much as they are a true scientist, in their mode of endeavor, they're always aware of all the peculiarities and ways in which even their working hypothesis isn't covering all the sort of weird edge cases and eccentricities of that little domain of knowledge. And what happens is somehow, like, there's a sort of generalization about the dogma, what is prevailing, accepted wisdom in this space and that space, and then that gets sort of extrapolated into, again, this thing called the science that does tend to get worship, because, but it's a weird thing, because it's always sort of being upended by whatever the latest thing was. Like, well, latest study says X, and there's a sort of, we used to think X, but now we know. There's this always sort of, like, again, there's this I don't know. It's a story of where we're always, like, going to greater heights, but it doesn't feel like we've had anything like a sort of, where Einstein's relativity or these big, discoveries of the nature of reality in recent memory, where we're like, everybody's kind of sort of captivated by science's ability to give us a window into a new world. Like, it feels like, and there are people that are actually doing that, but it's sort of like in these little pockets, like, with Michael Levin and others that are like, they're really getting down in the weeds of their particular area, and whatever hypothesis they're working with now is just, again, it's instructive of future questions that they want answered badly. It's driven by curiosity in a grand sense of not knowing, rather than actually, if you get into this mode where you think we've kind of got it figured out, you basically, the scientific endeavor has come to an end. And I think that's a lot of what sort of passes for science is just sort of a rote handing over of dogma. And then also sort of like using that as a tool or a cudgel to, like, make fun of everybody that lived before the 21st century, and there's a weird thing, like, where we kind of stand on the shoulder of all these giants in the scientific enterprise, but we act like, because we can sort of, like, recite little, like, a mathematical theorem they came up with, that we somehow understand the richness of their perspective on this, and we don't, but we imagine ourselves as sort of standing on these precipices of, like, of mental heights, and that we're all, like, very enlightened, 21st century folks. But it's like, oftentimes we sort of are tricking ourselves, I think.
Well, I mean, there's two ways to think about that. Stand, like you just said, standing on the shoulders of giants means that we have a better perspective, higher perspective. But standing on the shoulders of giants, I mean, the way I always understood it was, I wouldn't be able to stand here if it weren't for all the things that came before, right? And to me, that's the perspective that Michael Levin takes, is that he doesn't take anything for granted. So when he has a question, he doesn't take for granted that what's already been found is the thing. He just wants to explore that question. And the way he's doing it nowadays is going back to many of these very old books and reading them and seeing what questions those guys had 100 years ago, 150 years ago. And he's saying, wait a minute, they had some legitimate questions that we just rolled right over because of the paradigm of the day. And so he's going back to some of these very old books and taking those questions and saying, let's explore them. Now, with the new tools that we have, we can explore these questions in new ways. And so he's just looking at it from a very practical standpoint. So, yeah, it's very exciting to see what's coming. And maybe Barfield will be proven true. Maybe the revival is coming.
Yeah, I definitely think, we're definitely coming to the end of some sort of, grand narratives about how things work for sure. I don't know. It seems what comes next, I don't know. But it definitely feels like the winds of change are really blowing at the moment.
Well, it's been fun talking about this with you. Did you have any final thoughts that you wanted to put out there?
Not that I could think of. I've really enjoyed it too, and always enjoy listening to your channel, even when we've gone through spells where we haven't been able to chat. I really appreciate all the time you pour into it, and just like the interesting people that you have conversations with. It's
There
been
really
really
are a lot of
enjoyable.
interesting people out there. And so lately I'm reading this, We Who Wrestle with God. I am on page 49, I think. Something like that. There is much in here, much to be said about what's in here. And it's so funny how things seem to weave together. Like this morning, I was reading this blog that I read every day, have read every day for almost 20 years. This woman by the
They
name,
write every day.
and she writes every day.
Wow.
Her name is Anne Althaus. It's althaus.blogspot.com. And she was a law professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and she retired just a few years ago. But even while she was still a law professor, she started writing this blog. And she's always tried to be somewhat non-political so that she could write about things from a lot of different perspectives. And so you're always going to get a pretty balanced perspective on things, but she also doesn't just write about political stuff. She writes about all kinds of things. And today, for some reason, she'd gotten onto this idea of the difference between on the different perspectives of control. And so she was thinking about George Orwell's ideas about control and three other historical figures. Some guy by the name of Maupassant, maybe, and a couple of other people, I forget who. But anyway, she got the idea. I'm going to ask Grok to have, or maybe somebody in the comments section, she said something like, I wish I could have these four guys to dinner and have them talk about their perspectives on control. And somebody in the comment section said, well, why don't you just have Grok write that for you? So Grok writes her a dinner dialogue over the issue of control. And the basic idea coming out of the whole conversation, and she had him write it twice. Oh, and Jim Morrison was one of them. Jim Morrison of the Doors. So, but the main idea that comes out of it is that is on turns out to be on, also on page 42 of We Who Wrestle with God. And I read this page today at the same time I read her thing. So Peterson says, we invite nature to express herself within the confines of those constraints in a manner that is attractive and interesting. Nature being the chaos, and the confines being the order, right? The walled garden. Nature representing freedom, and the confines representing control. So these guys are having a conversation about freedom and control. And of course, Jim Morrison wants unrestrained freedom. one of the other guys who was some totalitarian, he wants unrestrained control. And Orwell is coming in and saying, no. You have to think about control and freedom in the proper perspective. And then I run into Peterson talking about freedom and control in the proper perspective. And it's just interesting how these things all fold together, you know? So I will link to Althaus's dialogue for anybody who's interested. It's quite amusing and instructive to see what Grok can come up with and how creative it can actually be. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, that's like the one I think I've played with most of the large language models. That's probably the only one I haven't spent some time with. Do you recommend it? It's pretty
I haven't played with Grok.
okay.
I think you have to pay extra for Grok, don't you?
I thought I saw some announcement like that they were opening it up, but
Oh, maybe. I mean, I do pay for the check mark on X just so that I can leave my DMs open and people can
I
contact.
think if you pay for that gave you
Oh, I thought you had to have some extra thing beyond that
Oh,
for Grok, but
I thought it gave you better access to Grok if you had
I play with
the
Claude
check
quite a
mark.
bit because Claude is, if I rather than using a search engine for some things, I'll have Claude draw a whole bunch of stuff together for me, and that's quite helpful. Or if I've read a book and then I want to talk about the book on my channel and I just want a quick summary of the book, I'll
Yeah.
ask Claude to give me a summary of the book. And usually it's a little bit off, but then if I remind him, well,
Yeah.
what about this thing and that thing? And I go through a few iterations, it'll give me a pretty good summary. But I have to know what the book is about. I would never ask it to summarize some book I haven't read because there'd be no legitimacy to the
Yeah.
summary
It
at all.
is a really good tool for saving time in areas where you have some expertise, but yeah, it is it's they're all very dangerous if you take them for the gospel. Like yeah, it's very interesting.
So anyway, this has been great, and I hope we get talk again in the new year. And so this is Maxon's, what birthday, what Christmas is this going to be for Maxon? His third?
He a fourth. He turns 4 in February, so this will be his
His third
I feel like
Christmas.
is that right? Yeah, I guess it's his third Christmas. Yeah. But yeah, he's loving it. He's he's still in the mode where he believes in all the things, so it's really magical to watch him.
Yeah, when my daughter was that age, we would always try to take a picture of her when she was opening her gifts. And she instead of letting us take the picture, she'd run around and want to see what was on the other side of the camera. Like, what are you looking at? She'd come running around and want to see what we were looking at.
Sorry.
What we're looking at is no longer there. You don't stay where you're supposed to be. The eternal debate between freedom and control. Okay. Good talking to you. Talk to you soon.
Here. Take care.